All right, welcome to Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show, we got one. It's pretty clear what one of the movies that inspired this was. We're talking about Dr. Sleep, which is it is an official sequel, but in a way, it just feels like a movie inspired by the first one, The Shining, the classic horror film. Written, of course, based on the book by Stephen King, and of course, directed by Stanley Kubrick. With me today is Chris Cranock, and I'm just going to tell you right at the top of the show, we did not like this movie very much. We had a great time talking about it, though. We had a great time watching it, actually, because we were laughing the entire time, and that is certainly not the goal of Mike Flanagan and Stephen King and those involved in making this movie. But I hope you go and see it. And then, of course, listen to this episode. And if you do like Piecing It Together, we'd love it if you'd rate and review us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Of course, make sure you're subscribed on your podcast app of choice. And join the Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all these movies. So I'd say let's go ahead and jump into this conversation because we got a nice long talk about a lot of great horror movies and a lot of bad stuff too along the way. So let's jump into this conversation about Dr. Sleep. All right, Chris Cranock back on the podcast. And for those of you who have listened before and heard Chris on the show, you may know a little bit about Chris and how much he has been himself inspired by the filmmaker whose film inspired the movie we're talking about today, sort of. Chris, why don't you tell people, just so that the ones who don't know you, mm-hmm. get a little idea of you before we get into this conversation.
Okay. So, yeah, for those of you who have heard this before, you've known that The Shining, the 1980 Stanley Kubrick film, is usually a puzzle piece on almost every movie, no matter what it is. No, not necessarily true. I somehow get back to talking about it.
Sure.
So I'm a super fan of The Man in general and The Shining in particular. I'm a filmmaker myself. I'm currently making a movie with the incredibly wonderful and rare support of Mrs. Stanley Kubrick, a woman named Christiane Kubrick, Stanley's wife. She has volunteered her original artwork, which appeared in Stanley's films, to be a part of my film. It's an immense honor, especially for a person who's been such a fan of her husband's work and of her work. So it's a very big deal. So I guess I should give a little bit of a disclaimer here. I did not walk into Dr. Sleep ready to hate it.
Right.
I wasn't like ready to love it because of my fandom, and I wasn't also like already hating it and burying it before I even took a look at it. It's not even a sequel to me. It has almost no relation to The Shining, in my opinion. This is a totally standalone movie, and I was excited. I wore my Shining sweater.
And you looked great, by the way.
It's very slimming. and I was ready just to take it on its own terms. So now that you know, I'm not here just to piss on it.
So now let's piss on it.
But now I'm just gonna objectively piss on it.
And to be clear, we were just talking about this before we hit record. You know, this episode is going to come out the day that the movie hits theaters. We saw it at a special early fan event thing, and it seems the general consensus is that this is good. I mean, I guess we'll find out. We'll find out when, like, all the critic reviews start rolling out and everything today, you know? But
people thought the Joker was good. I mean, another conversation, another episode, and I'm just fucking with you.
I will defend the Joker. I just don't get it. I don't get how this movie is getting the good reviews that it's getting. But we both went in with open minds, I think, mm-hmm. and we saw Silly. We were laughing the whole time, basically.
And that's the thing. It was extremely silly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing, is really my biggest fear about the movie, because I really tried to go in there as a blank slate, and I wasn't going in ready to, like I said, trash it because of the Kubrick Association.
Sure.
I was actually frightened because of the Stephen King Association.
Right.
So most Stephen King movies are awful.
Right.
And their biggest mistake is that they follow his work too closely.
Mm.
Anyone that, and this is just an opinion, there's a lot of people out there that are going to be furious by that comment.
Uh-huh.
But anytime you actually pay respect to Stephen King cinematically, it's a disaster.
Mm.
Because his books are not intrinsically cinematic. They're kind of sprawling, they're very overly complicated. They have a lot of subplots and character, like kind of he divulges in these long passages of things. They're messy, and they work sometimes well in books, mm-hmm. especially if they're about killer cell phones and stuff. Then I think he really shines. I'm throwing punches at him. I'm coming out hard. No, I'm just being silly. My biggest problem was Stephen King, and I think that's really that is the problem. I think the movie is as silly as maybe his book was.
Now that brings up a good question we should talk about before we get into this thing. Have you read Dr. Sleep?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Because that's another question, is whether or not this is a successful adaptation of the book. And I mean, I imagine maybe it is, but
it couldn't pass the movie. So Stephen King famously dislikes Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Right.
He made his own Shining, which is like 8 hours of just stab yourself in the eyes with needles, just with Steven Weber. It was a disaster. Maybe one day you'll be lucky to catch it on the USA Network.
Uh-huh.
But he wanted it to be a sequel to that film.
Mm-hmm.
And the filmmakers and Warner Brothers were like, listen, no one watched that. It was awful. We're gonna try to make this a cash cow. And if we're going to make it a cash cow, we're going to have to reference the Stanley Kubrick movie that everyone's familiar with, and that is iconic and has gone into the hearts and minds of millions. We're going to use that. And then Stephen King was probably just furious from the get-go.
I'm just picturing right now if he had gotten his way, and if it was a Stephen Weber lookalike in this movie.
They would have just had Stephen Weber do it. He would, of course, do it.
Oh my God. Well, you know, we're going to get into all the different things that we want to, you know, talk about throughout this conversation. Why don't we just get it going with some puzzle pieces? What do you got first?
Okay. So my very first puzzle piece is Son of the Mask. Okay. Which I think, if you think about it for more than a second, is totally appropriate.
Uh-huh.
So it's just, I think for me, the deepest connection is a totally unnecessary sequel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing is that, and this is my beef with the book, even though I haven't read it, so sorry. But I guess I just have a philosophical problem with the book and the movie to begin with, which is that the story behind the book is that someone at a book signing said, hey, Steve, whatever happened to Danny Torrance?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I don't know. Let's write 800 pages about it. And to me, that's not an essential enough reason to dive into a novel. I think too many things are made today with what-ifs as mm-hmm. their launching pads.
Sure.
You know, it's like, oh, we have endless streaming. We have to fill in an infinite number of hours with television. Like, what happens if we took a pill where our entire brain worked and all of our brain potential worked?
Right.
You know, limitless. You know, it's like there's too many, like, college screenwriting graduates sitting in a LA apartment going like, what if this?
Yeah.
And I feel like this was Stephen King's moment where he did a what if.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the story in general feels that way. And I think the movie ends up kind of feeling that way too.
Mm-hmm.
And so Son of the Mask is just so arbitrary and ridiculous. And like, you know, came out 25 years after the original movie.
Right.
And this came out 40 years after the original movie. And it's like, did it need to exist at all?
Right. And I actually don't believe I ever saw Son of the Mask, luckily, but I'm assuming it tries to maybe answer a few questions that never needed answers.
Yeah, exactly. That's
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That thing is like The Shining, the original Shining, the film, the Kubrick version, makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch that film, it doesn't make any sense at all. Is Jack a ghost? Is he not? Was he the caretaker? Was he a butler? Was he there in this, like, back in the 70s when Grady killed them, or was he in the 20s?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's not supposed to.
Right.
You know, horror films can work on some type of kind of subconscious level, and they just need to make just enough sense.
Yeah.
And I think a big problem with a lot of modern cinema in general, but particularly horror films, is that they answer way too many questions,
mm-hmm.
and they added questions and answers to the Shining mythos that the original Shining never needed.
Right.
We don't need these questions even raised, let alone answered. And Dr. Sleep was giving us all kinds of things in that regard.
And I have to assume, so you haven't read Dr. Sleep. Have you read The Shining?
Yeah, I read the original Shining. Yeah.
Does it get, because I haven't, and does it get into all any of this stuff that they're trying to answer here? The stuff that's not in the movie, but that is answered in the sequel to the movie? You know, or is that all just new, like no basis for it?
Well, I'm trying to think. I read it a pretty long time ago. I think the biggest thing, the major differences in the book is really how much the hotel plays a part in the insanity of Jack. Like the Jack Nicholson version, he really is the villain. He becomes the Frankenstein's monster. You know what I mean? The hotel's is Dr. Frankenstein, and Jack becomes the monster. Mm. And there's a lot more of those themes explored, I think, of the father-son betrayal and relationship, to where I think there's much more supernatural going on in the book, which again is very much in Stephen King's milieu. It's like he loves the supernatural. If there's not a big spider at the end,
you're right.
It's something spooky is going on. And so I think there were things raised in the original novel that maybe the Dr. Sleep movie kind of approached. I mean, for me, Dr. Sleep worked the best within its first hour.
Mm-hmm.
I think the opening half hour was a little tedious of recreating famous moments from like after The Shining, like, you know,
sure,
with a Dick Halloran ghost and all that. And that was a little tedious as a Kubrick fan. You know, I was kind of rolling my eyes, but again, I was like, let's do it. This is cool. Okay. Like trying to be positive. And then I think when we got into Danny suffering from his own alcoholism,
mm-hmm,
I was the most intrigued.
Right.
That was like a story.
It's not really answering questions. It's just continuing the character.
Yeah, and that's okay with me. That was okay. And I mean, and they actually did it well, I thought. It wasn't overly indulgent or ridiculous. And I think Ewan McGregor was doing a pretty good job.
Sure.
And then it just like really went off the rails.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there's definitely things that kind of crop up in the original. But the thing is, I mean, speaking of Frankenstein's monster, I think Dr. Sleep is kind of a Frankenstein's monster because it was supposed to be a sequel to a book,
mm-hmm,
and they forced it to be a sequel to a movie that never needed a sequel.
Right.
And I think that there was probably a lot of tug of war of like what went in and what didn't. How much time do we dedicate to the Kubrick film and all those nods?
Yeah.
And how do we tell a competent story that needs to be told?
That's a really difficult balancing act right there.
They fell off the high wire.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, you went with a funny one for your first one, and I'm going to go with a funny one too. My first puzzle piece is Good Will Hunting 2 Hunting Season. Specifically, of course, Ben Affleck's line reading of, "Are we going to have a problem again?"
Which, hey, like them apples, bitch.
Which, yeah, I mean that's what this movie is. It's recreating things. It's callbacks. It's every bad tendency of a sequel.
Yeah,
you know, which is exactly what Kevin Smith was skewering with that little moment within Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Oh yeah, and brilliantly, so funny. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think we're really overestimating the power of nostalgia in the vehicle of cinema.
Right.
You know, like nostalgia is a very powerful emotion. And I think when it's done very sparingly, it can be extremely effective.
Sure.
But I think when you basically make a whole movie of throwbacks,
mm-hmm,
it's troublesome.
Well, that's going to tie into one of my future puzzle pieces. But what do you got for your next puzzle piece?
I think so this one's a little bit more serious. I'm going to say with the new It Part 1 and Part 2.
Okay.
Maybe more Part 1 than 2 because they're so similar. They're so close in release date.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that I think the new It kind of put a fire under these Stephen King adaptations, and people are like, okay, we can do them new and modern and scary. And I think that they actually share a lot of similarities. And I don't know if it's just because they have the source material written by the same person, or if it's just the kind of motif that we're working in, but they feel the same, like in terms of their visuals and in terms of their cinematic vocabulary.
Yeah.
I think they share a lot. And I think maybe Dr. Sleep was greenlit on two conditions, like the box office receipts of It, and the Kubrick Association.
Sure.
So, yeah, I just feel like there is like It kind of paved the way for a movie like this.
I absolutely agree. I actually had It Chapter 2 specifically on my list, and yeah, it is a little recent, but I do think that it comes from the same Stephen King thing of just these things that don't really lend themselves too well to the screen.
Yeah, to the screen.
Yeah, exactly. And like the whole underground moment at the end of It Chapter 2, mm-hmm, was just so silly. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like to see that happening on screen, I'm sure it probably plays out, you know, really terrifying in the book, you know? And on screen, though, it just comes out as silly. And you're like, you know, what exactly is this? What is happening? Why is he turning into a giant spider thing? Like, right, you know, like, what? You don't really get enough in a cinematic way. No. And I felt that a lot of Dr. Sleep was the same thing. It's like it's bringing up this whole world of characters and ideas and rules and all this stuff, mm-hmm. but none of it is explored in any real way. It's just all just thrown out at you, just right. One beat after another.
Well, yeah, because in cinema, you can't explain things. And right. The thing is, bad movies do try to explain things, and this movie did try to explain, but kind of in its own clumsy movie way, where they just like give you flavors of dialogue and then they just show you things.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, they're being clever. They're not telling you, they're showing you.
Right.
Yeah, that's not very good logic. In cinema, yes, you want to show more than tell.
Yeah.
But you have to make something that is intrinsically cinematic.
Yeah.
Like the thing about one of the, you know, brilliant things about the original Shining, and you're going to hear that me say that a lot this time, so sorry in advance.
Sure.
But is that he was, you know, Stanley was able to distill the essence of the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Is another thing for me, if you look at The Dark Knight, for instance, I'm not a huge Chris Nolan, like, you know, freak. I think he hasn't made a good movie since The Dark Knight, in my opinion. So this is trying to be as objective as possible. But you look at The Dark Knight, and it distills the essence of Batman.
Right.
It's not that accurate to a Batman comic, but it feels like Batman. And I feel like finding the feeling is really the most important thing.
Yeah, being a full-on adaptation of everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of Watchmen, the Zack Snyder version, which is like page for page.
Right.
And it doesn't work for me. I think it brings up the idea of like, how important is medium?
Mm-hmm.
What are you really, are you writing it for this? Are you writing it to be a play? And can every play be turned into a film? Or can every book be turned into a film? I mean, the answer is no. I think we have emphatic evidence that not every book can be a film.
Right.
And not every film can be a book.
Sure.
And that's, I mean, these are not just always, we can't just cross these lines and blur them. I think great artists do things in their medium.
Yeah.
And I think even Stephen King, who like, I'm not a huge fan of, I don't think he's brilliant or a master or anything like that, but he has had his great moments and he's a huge part of our culture and he deserves that credit.
Sure.
And his early books or his really acclaimed books, they do what they're supposed to do in their medium.
Right.
So I think, I think people mistakenly think that like they're fodder for movies, but they're just not.
You know, one last point on that before I move on to my next puzzle piece, but when I looked it up, I was shocked. I didn't know this ahead of time that Dr. Sleep was written in 2013.
Yeah, 13.
That's crazy. Like for such a recent book to you know, make the way to screen like this.
Yeah.
And like, especially that long after an original, like, it's very strange, like that process and all of the for it to feel so old kind of, but not have taken in any of pop culture over the last like, you know, 40 years or whatever. Like, yeah. That's pretty wild, I think. Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, in the movie they did reference, what'd they say? Netflix. I think Netflix actually got a name drop in Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
Which I was like, okay, interesting. Like, remind us where this movie will be dumped and no one will ever watch it.
So I'm going to go with my next puzzle piece. I'm going to, well, you know what? I was just saying that, you know, we were talking about the nostalgia. I was going to say about one of my pieces was going to come back to that. So I might as well bring that one up now. It's Ready Player One. What, you had that?
I had it too, baby. Yep.
Yeah, especially, I mean, come on, the Shining tribute scene, of course, this is basically that spread out for a whole movie.
2 hours and 40 minutes.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, it certainly, I think people really, it was a lot of people's favorite part of the movie. So, I mean, I'm sure it brought it, you know, like you said about it bringing up Stephen King again into pop culture. I'm sure that that helped pave the way for this a little bit.
Right. Well, the thing is, you know what? It goes to show you that there are no rules because I am Steven Spielberg's first critic, you know, his biggest critic. But I walked into Ready Player One and I had a great time.
Sure.
And that thing only survives on nostalgia.
Yeah.
It's like its function. It is like, it's basically walking through a mall.
Yeah.
You know? and it like breaks all of my philosophical rules that I hold. That movie, type of movie, proves are arbitrary because I had fun and I liked it. The movie worked.
Yeah.
And the Shining scene was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually thought the Shining sequence was really well done. It worked well enough within the framework of the movie. It didn't feel like these really weird rehashed scenes like in this Dr. Sleep film with these other cast actors.
Yeah.
Like, they tried to recast Jack Nicholson.
That's insane.
Insane to me.
My God.
Bonkers. What are they doing? So, and then real quick, before I forget, I just need to touch on the audacity of Dr. Sleep to be the same length as the masterpiece that is the original movie. You make us sit through this inferior film for 2 hours and 40 minutes. Insane. It's almost as insane as recasting Jack Nicholson.
And I don't have numbers in front of me, but how many of those minutes are recreations of the original scenes? Like
at least 30%.
Yeah, like a solid amount. And that's crazy.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really, really crazy. But so, you know, Ready Player One really works. And it's one of those things like, you know, there is no formula to make a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do X, Y, Z and have it work out. I really think it comes down to intention.
Mm-hmm.
I think it comes down to like vision.
Yeah.
And Steven Spielberg, despite all his flaws and all you know, all of his evil businessy things that he's ruined American cinema with, he has a vision for stuff.
Sure.
You know, he's a great, talented person. It's one of the reasons why he infuriates me, because he's so brilliant and such a genius and so great at making films. And he just makes mostly terrible movies for money. You know what I mean? It's like he's a prostitute, and it's heartbreaking because he's so good. Mm. Like the best prostitute ever. But that's the thing is, you know, there was something about Ready Player One that had kind of an inspired vision about it.
Mm.
And that Shining scene was actually great and really fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
The opposite of all the Shining scenes in Dr. Sleep. Not great and not fun.
Exactly. Well, what do you got for your next piece?
I was going to say Ready Player One. Why don't we stay on our Steven Spielberg tangent? I'm going to have to say Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
All right.
Only because he teams up with a child. Which I don't know if that's like an what started that trope.
Mm-hmm.
Of like the adult being changed by the innocence of a child.
Yeah.
But that's a bad one.
Yeah.
And they laid that on pretty thick in Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
And just that ending when she walks into the bathroom. Oh, horrible.
That was so bad. I don't know if you remember, I had my jaw was open during that ending. I was like, it's not going to end now.
No. I was keeping track. I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was at least 4 or 5 times that they showed you the naked old lady image.
Yeah.
So they showed that to you one time in The Shining.
Right.
Because that's where it's most effective.
Sure.
They then took that very famous image and showed it to you 5 times.
And let me tell you, you know what, this is a good moment to admit to our audience that I am a little bitch when it comes to horror movies. I get scared at horror movies, okay? And I will sometimes look away from the screen. I'll look down at my popcorn, you know, just to not see the scary thing.
It's okay, fair enough.
And the old lady image in The Shining is really fucking scary.
Yeah, it scarred me for life.
Yeah. It's not scary at all.
No,
in
zero.
This. It is funny. It's 100% funny. I don't believe that the intention was anything other than funny. Like, no. I don't see how they were, and I keep hearing that this movie is really scary, and that's why I just don't understand it.
No. It's not scary in the slightest.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's, like I said, not to just take a constant shit on it, the best part of it was the drama of Ewan McGregor's adult life.
Right, because at least then you were getting something, like, with a little bit of weight to it.
Yeah, and it was actually interesting. Like, what happens if your dad tried to kill you when you were a kid?
Yeah.
And you don't understand everything about The Shining. I mean, I would have definitely omitted the wise Dick Halloran ghost to explain everything to you. That does not help Danny.
Or just lean in and have him the whole time. Have him be the sidekick.
They eat screams! I was like, oh my god, this is bad. We'll get to that in a second. We'll come back to that.
Sure.
But yeah, you actually had a ghost character that comes back and explains things to you. I mean, it's like, you know, screenwriting class 101, like, don't do that.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, let's think, because Danny's confusion and his alcoholism and his mixed feelings about his father and his childhood and his past. Like, I would have loved if they just had this guy go to this town and start, like, helping old people die.
Yeah.
Which is where the name comes from, right?
Yeah.
That's an interesting plot to me.
Yeah, that, like, was some of the most interesting stuff.
And the thing is, I mean, it was really cheesy because he's, you know, obviously I'm a stone cold atheist, and he's like, there's something more. I was okay.
Right.
Part of me rolled my eyes there. But again, not every movie has to align with my personal beliefs.
Exactly.
So I don't care that it said, yeah, that's perfectly fine. Most of the world believes there's something beyond death. So if you want to make a movie about that, that's perfectly good. And I was actually very intrigued by that idea.
Yeah.
And if I was the screenwriter, Which maybe I should have been. I mean, I know that. I know that's an elitist, insane thing to say. I'm just gonna say it. I should have probably written this movie.
Right.
And if I did, I would have probably made the whole movie about him going to this town, recovering from alcoholism, and helping old people die. Yeah. That would have been the entire story.
Yeah. So,
I think the Soul Eaters would have probably been left out of my my rough draft. Might have not brought them back.
But they're so hip and cool.
Oh my god! With her Heisenberg hat. Oh, it's the magic hat. What's it called?
Rose the Hat.
Oh yeah. What's the guy's name?
Oh,
Crow Daddy.
Crow Daddy.
So this is the kind of quality we're talking about. Rose the Hat, Crow Daddy.
Yeah.
And there was who's the pedophile girl?
Grandpa Jim. Oh, and that was like Rattlesnake something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
Oh my god.
How many executive meetings did they get through where everyone's like, yeah, I'm cool with all these names. Proceed.
Well, you know, all this talk about the ghosts just made me think of a puzzle piece I hadn't thought of previously, so I'm going to throw it out right now as my next one. That is The Frighteners, Peter Jackson's film, which I love, by the way, but just all these kind of silly ghosts.
Great film.
Yeah, it's great.
A dear friend of mine, Peter Dobson, is in that film.
Oh, really?
He's the husband that dies and becomes a ghost.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a great actor and a good friend of mine.
Nice.
Yeah, and Frighteners is amazing.
Yeah, so good. But I mean, you know, it is like each of the ghosts is like kind of like this, I guess, film archetype. Like,
yeah, comic extension.
Yeah. And they really kind of lean into that in a movie that otherwise should be scary, but is kind of like I said earlier, it's like it feels like they're playing it for laughs.
Well, here's the irony about that, because that's actually a good launching pad. Because if you watch the original Shining, I already warned you guys I was going to do this a lot. It walks a tightrope of being funny.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, there is such a fine line between terrifying and humorous.
Sure.
There really is. Yeah. I think good horror films that deal in the supernatural, like, for instance, there's a famous Stanley Kubrick story where he called up the filmmakers behind the original Vanishing, the film from the Netherlands. And they didn't even believe it was him. They hung up the phone because he's like, this is Stanley Kubrick. And I thought someone was pranking them. Mm-hmm. So he called back and finally got through and was like, no, it's really me. And I think you made the scariest movie I've ever seen. And they said, well, what about The Shining? And he's like, this is real.
Right.
He's like, The Shining isn't real. This is the real. This is truly scary.
Yeah.
A film like the original Vanishing doesn't have to walk that fine line of humor because it's so palpably scary.
Right.
But when you deal with ghosts and hauntings and goblins, things that are at their base absurd, things that are truly insane, you have to balance that. I mean, there's a guy in a bear costume blowing another party guest in The Shining. You know, there's... And Jack Nicholson's performance, which he actually got a Razzie Award for, is so over the top.
I didn't know that until just recently. That's
he got
crazy.
A Razzie. It's actually Stanley got a Razzie, too. He had a Razzie, but he didn't get a Best Oscar for directing, so there you go.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is, you know, Steven Spielberg, when they asked him, when Stanley asked him what he thought of The Shining, he kind of heed and hawed. He kind of hemmed and hawed. He didn't know what to say because he didn't love it.
Mm-hmm.
And Kubrick said, well, what are your top five favorite actors? And he named all these classical actors. And Kubrick said, well, you didn't name James Cagney. That's why you didn't understand my film.
Mm.
Yeah, this was The Shining is vaudevillian in a lot of ways. It's an over-the-top exaggeration, and it's silly, but it can also be bone-chilling and extremely terrifying. Yeah. What's even more terrifying is the symbolism. You know, the thing about a father betraying a son, betraying the family.
Yeah.
Those deeper themes, I think, resonate more with us. And then we could also laugh at The Shining.
Yeah.
The problem with Dr. Sleep is that it feels like it's playing for laughs, but it isn't.
Yeah.
It's deadly serious.
Yeah.
And it's so self-serious that it becomes absurd. It's like you have to kind of almost be aware of the irony of horror to be able to make a horror film well. And if you're not aware of that irony, then you just become very self-serious and then you become hysterical.
Right.
So you eat yourself alive. It's this incestuous process to make a horror movie. So it's just fascinating.
Yeah, I think Rose the Hat is a perfect embodiment of that idea right there. Because, I mean, and you know, I think she did a great job. She seems like she's having a lot of fun with the role. Let's put it that way. It just isn't. It's not scary at all.
It's ridiculous.
This total just scenery chewing, fun performance.
Well, and that thing is classic Stephen King to write a part like that.
Yeah.
I mean, to have a gang of these people. That's something that comes back to answering all these questions that don't need to be answered. Like, why did The Shining, why did the hotel turn on, you know, turn Jack crazy.
Right.
Not important.
Right.
That's like the least important part of The Shining.
Right.
And now there's a whole mythology behind why.
Yeah.
It's like this evil force, and that there's these other creatures that need to eat, and it's so they need to do this to be able to survive, and they work off this energy, and it's like, fuck that. We don't need any of that.
Yeah.
And it actually brings me to a puzzle piece, but sure. I think it's your turn, isn't it?
No, yours. You're
okay. Yeah. So I'm going to combine a few.
Sure.
But I'm going to have to say, they seem totally insane, but Get Out and Us, so the Jordan Peele films, but also The Matrix Reloaded.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with Matrix Reloaded, and it's only because it adds to the mythos without any of it being important or necessary.
Right. It doesn't actually elevate the first one at all.
Zero. Yeah. It's just making things more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to Jordan Peele stuff, I liked Get Out more than I liked Us. I don't think Get Out is quite the movie people claim that it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an important film for what it is and when how it was made, but standing, you know, in terms of its, I think, political heft and bringing a strong African-American director to the forefront of that genre picture, I think all of those things are accurate and important. But the movie itself, I think, if you're looking at it objectively, is an above-average horror movie, but nothing else. I don't think it's like a seminal classic. You know, it's a good, interesting film with good ideas.
Right.
Us, I think, really blows. I think Us is a bad, bad movie. And one of the reasons why it's so bad is because it tried to explain away all of its mystery.
Right.
That thing is, it explained everything. And then it didn't make any sense.
Right. I was about to say, yeah, it explains everything, but then that really doesn't actually help you when
right.
it comes down to it.
It's like someone said to him, The Shining didn't make sense. And he was like, okay, I'll make sure my movie doesn't make sense. But here's 30 minutes of exposition.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the hands across America and where this is where the bunnies come from. And this is how this whole thing worked. And it's like, none of that's important or interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you give us that much information, then we want it to make sense.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're giving us that much, then we're going to try to put the dots together. And then when the dots don't add up, it's just stupid. It's not mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fine line. There's no rhythm. There's no recipe for a good film. I think it's more about intention and artistic integrity and vision.
Yeah.
And like you get lucky or you don't. And sometimes films work and sometimes they don't. So I don't think that this was like a nefarious effort by Jordan Peele to make a bad movie. I'm sure he tried to make the best movie he could. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. And its fatal flaw is that it tried to explain too much.
Sure.
So these movies just, they're taking all the fun out of it.
Yeah.
Stanley somehow knew that not knowing enough, like knowing the right amount, you know, just making the pieces fit on the surface, but letting us keep the mystery makes a movie that's so eternally interesting.
See, and I think Get Out does it really well.
It does
and
it
like,
better.
Like you said, you do like that movie. And I mean, I do think that one, you know, raises enough questions while answering enough questions while not answering quite everything, you know, and I think it does a really good job of that. But I agree. Us, though, is a little bit much. Yeah,
man, because the thing is, like, again, it's horror movies are easy to start and very difficult to finish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can write a great half hour, a great 40 minutes, a great hour.
Yeah.
But how do you end it?
Yeah.
When the thing is how the stakes are so high in a horror movie, right? You just gradually move into more and more absurdity. You get bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, how do you bring that to a satisfying end? Sci-fi has the same problem. You can definitely pose a very interesting question with a sci-fi movie. Mm-hmm. But then how do you wrap that up in a satisfying way through a narrative? And a lot of people blow that ending as well. A movie like Ex Machina, I thought, did that. I think it was like one of the most fascinating movies until like the last 15 minutes.
Oh, I love the ending.
Yeah, okay.
I'm on board with it.
Well, I don't dislike it. I just think it, I want, you know, when you ask a question of such abstraction, it's hard to funnel it down into a narrative.
Oh, yeah. It's a difficult movie to end.
You know, it's hard. I'm not sure if they quite stuck it. I don't hate it. I think it's a good film, but I just didn't like really connect with it.
Mm.
And that's the thing is like, again, sorry, but 2001 A Space Odyssey, it starts big and it ends bigger, but it's open-ended.
Right.
And it's about its ideas more than it is about its narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important, you need to pick. If you're in a genre piece and, you know, it's like Prometheus had these excellent ideas of like where we start as, you know, from human race. And then it's like, with a fist fight. Yeah, it's like this big zombie guy wakes up. He's like, bah, bah, bah. And that's just like, okay, that's where we're going to take this movie.
He's an ancient alien race, and he just straight up rips that guy's head
off. Yeah, and he's like super pissed about it. So, yeah, I mean, so it's, yeah, and that's the thing is I know, like, I sympathize. I don't have all the answers, and I have yet to make a huge scale horror film and sci-fi movie. So put me to the test when I get to that point in my career. Mm-hmm. I have movies planned. We'll see if they ever get made. And so, yeah, and I'm not trying to sound like I have all the answers. I might totally blow it too, mm-hmm. but I try to be extremely aware of these things.
Yeah.
And I think that, with horror and sci-fi, both the plot is what fails you.
Mm-hmm.
When you try to satisfy the narrative more than you try to satisfy the ideas behind the narrative, you run into trouble because mm-hmm. it's easy to start big, but it's really hard to stick the landing.
Sure. Well, speaking of big questions and big answers, for my next puzzle piece, I'm going to go with the Twilight series.
Okay, love it. And, I totally understand what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, the main drive of this story, more so than anything with Danny's character, is this weird group of soul-sucking vampire crew. They're like a little gang.
It's
and
trash.
They're it's total trash.
Bad idea.
And they're all like just super cool and just oh, yeah. really hip. And
so
just,
hip.
I mean, it's just so weird.
Crow Daddy.
It's Crow Daddy. There's a guy named Crow Daddy.
If that doesn't sum it up for you of what a bad idea it is.
I mean, I just don't know how they thought that was all right. Like how they thought that was going to be good. But yeah, and I mean, I haven't even seen all the Twilight movies. I just remember it was like this cool little gang of vampires yeah. versus another gang. But and I'm sure if this movie does well, we'll get a sequel where there's roving gangs of soul sucking vampire creatures. You know,
right.
I don't know. But yeah, and I texted you after we saw this. I said if I had told you a decade ago there was going to be a sequel to The Shining, and in it there would be a shootout with vampires, would you believe me? And
no.
Yeah,
I didn't think the Kubrick estate would allow it. I have marginally more access than the average person,
right.
and I want to use that power to understand. They must have had zero input.
Yeah,
and that's the thing is, I mean, Warner Brothers owns all these things, you know. And once Stanley, a very famous perfectionist and very in control of his work. Who knows what's happened in the intervening 20 years since his passing.
Sure.
But I don't think, my guess is they had nothing to do with it. I stayed and we watched the entire credits and there was not one name that I recognized mm-hmm. of a person of any type of value representing the Kubrick side of this.
I think we're going to see more things like that in the future.
For sure.
I gotta say, especially like nowadays, I mean, you know, it's funny, actually, while I was, like, making my notes for this, I kept getting my thoughts mixed up with Terminator Dark Fate, which we're doing an episode on in a couple of days. But again, it's like the taking these old, you know, things and trying to make a sequel a long time down the road.
Yeah.
And it's just like when nobody asked for it. You
yeah.
know?
That brings me to my puzzle piece because it's my turn, right?
Yeah.
The Halloween franchise / Rob Zombie, like, weird side movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I have one more movie actually that I was going to keep separate, but the point is so close, I'm just going to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Ready? Shaft from 2019.
All right. I still haven't seen it.
Because it's a reboot and a sequel, and it has the same name as the movie from 15 years ago, which
sure.
I still don't understand.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is, I think Dr. Sleep is a great example. Maybe not the worst example, because there's way worse examples of this, but it's a symptom of another problem, which is just the free-for-all that we're in right now of reboots and remakes and sequels and re-sequels and reimagines and all this stuff. It's like there was a Halloween that came out recently. There was a sequel to Halloween 2.
Yeah.
Even though there was like Halloween 6.
Yeah.
And they were like, we're going to ignore those other ones.
That's exactly what Terminator just was.
That's the thing is, what is this? This is a new subgenre of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's not a reboot, it's a sequel, but then they're ignoring part of the franchise, and then there's other people simultaneously making other versions, like Rob Zombie making his Halloweens.
Yeah.
And there's three Batman, and there's three Spider-Man, and there's a movie from an AMC show, from a TV show made into a movie on Netflix. Like, what is going on?
I don't want to report internet rumors here on the show, but I read today, which I thought was interesting, that, you know, supposedly the next Doctor Strange is supposed to be a horror movie, a horror
just hopping
comic
into
book
genres.
Movie. Well, there's a rumor with that horror angle that it is going to go into the multiverse of the Raimi Spider-Man being a horror connection there, which would just be ridiculous and insane and actually a kind of interesting way of using this new thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I agree, though, this whole new thing is just... very strange, right. Very just unnecessary.
Well, that's the thing, is I don't want to stifle innovation, but this doesn't seem like innovation. It seems like a cash grab. It seems like people fighting at the door of a Best Buy on Black Friday. That's what it seems like. This is not innovation. Yeah. There is no rule saying that you can't make the Raimi movies into the universe of Doctor Strange. But it's just a bad idea. It's just stupid.
Yeah.
And what it's going to really end up doing is just making the audience exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
We're already exhausted.
Yeah.
Three Spider-Mans ago, I was watching a preview for it in the theater, and someone in front of me turned to their friend and was like, what Spider-Man is this? They didn't know. Three Spider-Mans ago, they didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
So that's the thing, is we are movie people, right? People listening to this podcast are typically movie people, right? Yeah. They're reading about it. They follow it. They're on blogs. They're on this. They're on that. We're educated in this thing, and I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the average audience member? That's the thing, is if people are afraid about people staying in theaters and they don't want to lose that to the streaming services, make this simpler.
Right.
Because people are going to be like, I can't keep up with this.
No.
Even the big blockbusters, which are supposed to be easy. You can walk into a CVS and have, you know, buy, you know, like tampons with Spider-Man on it. And it's like, this is supposed to be easy. It's one movie. It's huge. You go and everything's on. Now it's, I can't keep up.
Well, before I move on to my next puzzle piece, was Shaft any good?
Of course.
Yeah.
It was excellent.
Okay.
Never saw it. It was the most, again, totally unnecessary. It was Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it was like, that's one of those things where you walk in with almost no expectation and you don't care. And as long as it is ridiculous, then it's good.
Yeah.
So it's one of those.
All right. Well, I don't want to just keep saying the same thing here, but I do have Ghostbusters on my list.
yeah, I mean, the thing is, how many things could we say?
Yeah.
It shouldn't have been made.
Yeah.
All right, go on.
But yeah, I mean, it's just silly ghost stuff. And I mean, I'm already starting to forget things that happened in this movie, but I think they were capturing souls in a canister.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, which is, you know, the classic Ghostbusters thing, so, you know.
I didn't even put that together, actually. Yeah. They actually did catch him in a canister.
Yeah.
And then sniff them.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is like, oh my God, what are they thinking? Because the guy that wrote this wrote Haunting on Hill House, the Netflix series.
Yeah.
Which was fine. I mean, there were some really good moments in there.
People really love Mike Flanagan. There's a lot of, like, fans that think that he is, like, one of the freshest voices in horror right now.
That is surprising.
Yeah.
I was going to say, my last puzzle piece would be like the Conjuring series.
Okay, yeah.
Because I feel like they all these movies feel the same. It's like a period horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And this is maybe a broader comment. Since we can't actually say anything interesting about Dr. Sleep itself, because we've already kind of beaten that horse to death.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest complaint is that everything looks alike.
Sure.
Visually. Everything looks like a Netflix TV show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from a cinematography standpoint. The camera moves, the film grammar, the lens choices, the color grading, the quality, the actual resolution, and the output of that. I mean, it all looks like a show,
right?
And like I tried to push Dr. Sleep out of my brain, but when I think back on it, I see images from The Conjuring.
Yeah.
I mean, they just have this cinematic quality about it that's the same.
I think part of the reason for that is those movies are so fucking successful.
Yeah.
People love them. They actually show up. People are going less and less to the theaters, but they show up for those movies, no matter how bad they are.
Yeah, and it's like an expanded universe of its own, isn't it? Isn't the Annabelle series in
there? There's like seven movies now or something.
But it's all other stories, and it all interconnects, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, I'm exhausted.
And actually, to that point, they all answer questions from The Conjuring that weren't necessary to answer, which is exactly what this is.
Well, that's the thing, is, I mean, we're in a stage in the industry right now where this has always been the case, but it's especially now, which is that, like, if something works, let's do it until it's dead.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that poses a problem for writers,
mm-hmm.
because you want to stay true to the source material, because you want to give the fans what they want, which I guess, I mean, in some regard is not always a bad thing. You know, I mean, it's okay. I don't think you should make a movie based on fan service. That was the problem with Endgame. It was just like 3 hours of fan service.
Sure.
Too much so. In my opinion, it wasn't a bad film or anything, but it just wasn't great either. I think Infinity War was way better, infinitely better, to use a very bad pun. Why not? I almost just did it without thinking.
Yeah.
So there you go. But these writers are backed into a corner where, like, okay, we need a certain amount of fan service.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, where'd we go with this story? If the movie was moderately good, then you don't have that much material to stretch into seven more movies. The Conjuring might have been a nice one and done.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It would have been. Yeah. Because it was a four. I'm really not a fan of like modernish horror movies, you know? Yeah. But no, that is one of the best ones, though.
Yeah.
And, but then they just, they've been spreading that whole thing out just as far as they can.
Till it's dead.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I was reading an article with Robert De Niro recently, and he was talking about how, you know, his experience in Joker, I think it was for GQ, is one of the few like real in-depth interviews he's done ever.
Mm.
So I was curious. I was reading about it. And they're talking about how there was rumors of a Taxi Driver 2.
Mm.
And I was like, what? Like, how is that even, like, and he said, oh yeah, Paul Schrader and Martin and Marty and I, we all talked about it, and there was never just a story, there's never an urgency or a story that we felt like we needed to tell. And it's like, how could there even be enough to make a meeting about it?
Yeah, that's crazy.
You know what I mean? Like, what is left in that story to tell besides just revisiting it?
Yeah.
And I think that Paul Schrader went off and made First Reformed, which was his doing that. It was him exactly. exercising those same demons and seeing a modern take on it. But to have the character like Travis Bickle come back as an older man is preposterous. Yeah. And and the biggest thing, it's not, like I said, I don't want to sound just like a mean-spirited movie, you know, one of the movie buffs that are insufferable. Like, I try so hard not to be that person, and mm-hmm. I know many of them. And that's why I love your show mainly, because you have really good, open-hearted people for the most part and with open minds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the best things about your show, and I try to be that type of person.
Right.
And so this is not just like me shutting out things because I'm an originalist or a purist, or it's just that there's no story there.
Right, right.
If there was a story for Taxi Driver 2, make it.
Yeah.
But there's not. Yeah, there's just not a story.
Good Will Hunting 2.
Applesauce. That's the line.
Applesauce bitch.
That's right. Applesauce bitch. That's it. I thought I got it wrong earlier, and then I was like, no, it's applesauce. I like when Gus Van Zandt's counting the money.
Yeah.
Like, Ben, busy.
I'm busy.
Some really funny stuff in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's just no story. And it's just sad because it's like, I mean, that's the thing, is I knew, I mean, like I said, just to reiterate, I walked into Dr. Sleep knowing that it would never equal The Shining,
mm-hmm.
and that I didn't even want it to. It's a totally separate beast. You know, I mean, how could it ever, I wanted to just judge it totally differently, and it just, there's just not enough story even for it to get by on its own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a bad movie because it's a bad movie, not because it was a disgrace to the Kubrick film from earlier.
Right.
You know, if it was a great version, I think, honestly, though, the other silver lining is it's going to get more people to maybe see The Shining.
Maybe, yeah.
Good.
Maybe.
Good.
That would be good.
Go see that.
Yeah.
And then
the 4K release just came out.
I know.
Yeah.
But the thing is that Kubrick films are eternal.
Yeah.
You know, I told one of the assistant that works closely with the family, my ex, you know, so we chat every now and again, and I told her that my experience is that a lot of youth was in the viewing was to go see The Shining in the theaters, and a lot of the room was kids.
Yeah.
And that's the power of a Stanley Kubrick film. I mean, they people still talk about them.
Yeah.
Still do. I mean, I was just in Italy. I made a movie in Rome, and it was a very exciting experience. And I was talking to one of the actors, and he was asking about what I'm really working on and what else is my other projects. I mentioned the film with the Kubrick family and all that stuff. And he said, oh my God, Clockwork Orange changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
This is like some Italian guy.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just the reach of it is unparalleled.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I only got one more piece, so we'll go for this and then close it out. But that is basically just the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe. It felt like this was a Marvelizing of the Shining world, yeah. Apparently. But yeah, I mean, everybody is just kind of quippy and clever, and everybody is just like kind of cool and hip, and they're just... you know, they're like just so overly likable, but not really. You know, I didn't like them, but I think that's what they're going for, is like these likable, cool guys,
yeah,
the bad
sure.
guys and everybody, you know, and they all have perfect little retorts at each other and stuff like that. And I just thought that was just very strange, but it does seem to be something that's happening a lot now.
Yeah. People are definitely too smart in movies.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing, is like, it's one of the things the Coen brothers do extremely well, is they write idiots extremely well.
Yeah, yeah.
And they write honest dialogue, even though it's very precise dialogue and sometimes anachronistic, and it's very specialized or heightened. It also always plays,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so, yeah, I think a big part of that is everyone's too cool for school.
Yes.
And that thing is, I think Ewan McGregor's the only one that wasn't.
Exactly.
He yeah. actually, like, there's something actually interesting. Like, I still stand by that Stephen King should have never written this book based on a what if,
yeah.
and the movie should have never been made. But
mm-hmm.
if you're going to proceed with it, there was an inkling of a good idea. with following a troubled man after that experience.
Yeah.
You know, and especially with the alcoholic angle, which was a huge part of Stephen King's original process of writing The Shining. He was an alcoholic and was suffering from that thing. It was like a lot about his animosity toward his own children. Mm-hmm. I read an interview where he's talking about how like the animosity one feels for their own child was a scary thought. And he thought that's the seed of a great book. And it was a great book. And then it's like the other kind of flippant what if. Yeah. I'm like, what's Danny up to? I wonder what he's doing. It's like, that's not a story. That's not a seed.
Yeah.
You know, but you had something there. Even still, there was something vaguely interesting there.
Absolutely. Well, let's close this thing out. We'll do the finished puzzle and get in any closing thoughts. But okay. Finished puzzle includes Son of the Mask, Good Will Hunting 2, Hunting Season, It Chapter 1 and 2, Ready Player 1, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, The Frighteners, Get Out, Us, Matrix, The Matrix Reloaded, The Twilight Series, the Halloween recent sequels, Shaft, the 2019 remake sequel-ish thing, The Conjuring Universe, and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Chris, you got any closing thoughts about this one?
No.
Let's forget this as soon as possible.
Yeah, I just want my final word is that if you are a big Kubrick fan, it's okay to like things that are inspired by him or even rip him off a little bit. You try to open your heart a little bit to those things. A lot of Kubrick people tend to be very like very specific and very protective of that stuff. And
let's be honest here, a lot of film snobs.
Yeah, film snobs. Yeah. And the thing is, I've never even tried to be very precious of it. And I think I've been so fortunate to be even vaguely associated with the man in the smallest way possible.
Yeah.
And I try not to be too precious about it. Mm. I mean, he was just a filmmaker, and like you have movies like Room 237, which is a travesty that I think every continuity error was a masterstroke of something he thought about 7 years before, which is ludicrous. Yeah. But that's the power that he had, is that he was such a visionary filmmaker that you could have people literally go crazy watching his movies and think a continuity error is a masterstroke. So there you go.
Yeah.
But just don't be too precious about it. You know, if you do like this movie, you're not an idiot. That's perfectly fine. Maybe you have no association to Kubrick at all, and so you just went in like totally clean slate, and that's fine. That's good. But my biggest thing is like, don't hate something because of the Kubrick reference, or don't love it because of the Kubrick reference. Try to be objective. If we were all better objective viewers, we'd maybe get better material. Mm. We'd get better movies. We need to hold these people to higher standards. We need to demand more from these studios. And we can't just watch anything that comes down the pike.
Yeah.
So that's, for me, it's always a reminder of like, be critical of things, but also be open. Don't be an asshole for you movie buffs out there.
There you go. I have two last thoughts I wanted to bring up real quick. First of all, I do want to applaud Mike Flanagan on showing a little bit of restraint and not having Frozen Jack still sitting out there. I 100% thought that was going to happen.
Yeah, me too.
Once I
saw Dick Halloran Ghost, I was like, all bets are off.
Yeah, I totally thought it was going to happen. And then also, again, obviously this isn't the intention of liking this movie or disliking this movie, but the two of us did get a really great laugh out of fuck you just say. So if nothing else, this movie gets a little bit of credit for that.
You put it perfectly in the script. It had like apostrophe fuck. Fuck you just say. She said that to Crow Daddy.
Yeah, she said it to Crow Daddy.
Had
she
balls
was, she
on
was
her.
Pissed.
Yeah. Rose the Hat has like some balls on her.
Rose the Hat. Oh my God.
It's shocking. It's shocking how silly the movie was.
So silly.
So without ever being intentional. That's the key right there.
Yeah.
It had no idea how stupid it was.
Yeah.
I guess let me end on one other anecdote. May I?
Sure.
So Stanley Kubrick would call Stephen King up and not know what he didn't know what time difference it was. It would be like the middle of the night in America, and Stephen King would be like sobering up or something, and he'd be like, "Hello," and Stanley would say things like, "Is this movie or is any ghost story at its core optimistic?" And Stephen King said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, it's saying there's something after death. Isn't that intrinsically optimistic?"
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen King thought, "Well, what about hell?" And there was a long pause, and Stanley said, "I don't believe in hell," and then hung up. And I think that is why we have the movie we have of The Shining.
Uh-huh.
So there you go.
I love it. I love it. Well, Chris, do you have another movie you saw recently that maybe you liked a little bit more than this one that you'd like to recommend?
The Lighthouse.
Ah.
And that's actually an interesting movie to talk about super briefly because I know we're wrapping up. But there is a movie that has virtually no story.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing to do with story. It's an atmospheric, it's like a campfire story brought to life visually.
Sure.
And that's, again, brings back to my point, no rhyme or reason, no magical way to tell a story, that you don't have to have a great script. You don't have to have a very wordy, dialogue-driven movie. You don't even have to have a good story. You can have a setup.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about The Lighthouse is that it's very cinematic in its bones.
Sure.
And I think it proves that even more because it's such a lark from a story standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But it works from an atmosphere standpoint so well. And the craft of it is also exceptional. And the performances. So I'd say go. And that's probably one of the... And that's the thing, that's a black comedy. That's another horror movie that walks the fine line of comedy and horror so masterfully. So definitely check out The Lighthouse.
Right on. And I did use The Shining as a puzzle piece on that episode.
That's my boy. I'm proud of you. You know why? Here's one last thing for you. Everything's The Shining.
There you go.
And if you don't think I'm right, watch The Shining and then watch everything else.
Yeah.
And guess what? It's The Shining.
I'm going to have him on next time for something that's just not The Shining at all. But you know what? It probably will
You be. Can bring me in for Isn't It Romantic? And I will find a way that Stanley Kubrick directly inspired them.
Yeah.
That's the thing is, you know what? Again, sorry, I keep saying last thing. But it's just he eked into all of our minds.
Mm-hmm.
He made such cerebral, great films that even if we're not directly related or directly influenced, he's in there.
Sure.
So he's,
especially filmmakers.
Yeah. He's in the language of movies.
Yeah.
And commercials and everything. He's everywhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Fucked you just say?
Fucked you just say?
Hi there, I'm Mike.
I'm Shani.
I'm Kev.
And together we present There Will Be Geek, a compendium and magazine of all the nonsense you can possibly eat about pop culture.
There's like a bomb duck to a toilet. No, toilet paper, it says boom, you're dead. How do you not like that?
2 podcasts a month.
Just going back to the ribbon removal to blow yourself thing. It always concerns celebrities who would in no way ever need to give themselves a blowjob. If Clint Howard removed a rib to blow himself, I can understand that, because who the f*** would?
So come along. You can find us on iTunes,
Libsyn,
SoundCloud, Facebook,
www.therewillbegeek.com.
Have a listen.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that conversation about Dr. Sleep. It's pretty great when we're able to get an episode done when it comes out in theaters. That doesn't always happen because, you know, we got to make sure I've got a guest who's seen the movie. I got to make sure I see the movie, and I don't always get into press screenings or anything like that. I'm not an official member of the press or anything, but we'll get there eventually. But no, it's great when we're able to do this, and I hope you're seeing this movie opening weekends. Go to the theaters, even though we didn't really love this movie. You might like it. A lot of people seem to love it. Maybe we're just assholes. I don't know. But I really, I can't stop laughing about some of the stuff that happens in this movie. And like I said, I wasn't scared for a second. And I really do look down at my popcorn sometimes during horror movies. Even horror movie trailers, they just scare me too much and I can't handle them. So the fact that this didn't scare me, I really don't understand how it scared anyone else. But maybe you'll like it. I don't know. So I want to remind you all to make sure you are subscribed to Piecing It Together on your podcast app of choice. You can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars would be amazing. You could also sign up for our Patreon, where for as low as $3 a month, you get access to special bonus content. And what kind of content? Well, right now there's an episode on Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, and that's basically about it. But we're about to record a whole bunch of extra episodes, and there's no way they're going to all go up right at the same time. I mean, there would just be no way to properly promote each episode. So they're all going to be up early in advance in the Patreon page, and you'll have access to them if you sign up. And then there's other things, too. You can get some of my music and a bunch of other stuff as other levels of the Patreon. So go check that out, patreon.com/piecingpod. Of course, follow us on social media at piecingpod. And all the other Piecing Pod stuff. Tee Public, buy one of our shirts. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff out there. Just search for Piecing Pod. We're out there. So let's leave you with a piece of music, as I always do, at the end of every episode of Piecing It Together. Trying to think of a good one to play for you guys. I think I'm going to play I think I've played this before on the show, but I think it fits with the creepiness and scariness that supposedly this movie has. This is a track called Scarecrow off a free album I released a few years back called Like Ashes. So enjoy this track, and we will be back with more Piecing It Together next week.
And all points west.